Public Safety Committee will come to order. Members, I need a motion to approve the minutes of February 27th. Representative Simonson makes that motion. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Today we have a report from the legislative auditor on the health services in the Department of Corrections facilities, and I apologize for our lateness last meeting that we weren't able to get to this, and it's very important, so we'll devote as much time as you need and get the department's responses, and if we have to do the bonding requests on another time, we will do that. So, Mr. Alter, welcome to the committee. Can you state your name for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Joel Alter with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I should mention that Jim Nobles had hoped to be here but had something else that came up this morning. And also with me today, sitting behind me, Sarah Della Cueva and KJ Starr, who also worked on this evaluation. I'm going to go through this presentation fairly quickly today. Feel free to stop me if questions come up, but I'll leave time so we have time for questions at the end. Let me start with the overall conclusions in this report. Overall, we concluded that inmates have access to a lot of health care in prisons. They live in facilities where medical staff are on duty every day. But we also found areas that need quite a bit of improvement. And when I say that, I mean more coordinated and consistent services. And there's also a need to update existing policies so that they conform better with professional standards. And of particular note, we think there have been very limited mechanisms for oversight and accountability of DOC's health services, and there's a need for DOC to sustain more active efforts at quality improvement. And let me begin with just a basic explanation. When we talk about health services, what do we mean by that term? Well, in its broadest sense, health services includes medical, mental health, and dental services. It also includes treatment provided to chemically dependent offenders and sex offenders. And the aggregate cost of these services in fiscal year 2013 was about $68 million. About $28 million of that was for DOC's contract with a health services provider. Health services account for about 20% of total prison costs. In addition to the contract expenditures, there are a lot of health services employees within the Department of Corrections, a total of about 440 FTEs. Our focus in this evaluation was on the medical, mental health, and dental services. We did not, in this study, look at chemical dependency or sex offender services. DOC's health services represent a blend of DOC's own employees and contract staff. The main staff who are employed by DOC are all of the nurses, the therapists who provide mental health services, and dental staff. And on the contract side, the contractor provides other staff, notably physicians and psychiatrists on site. The vendor is also required to arrange for various other services, laboratory services, and some of the others mentioned here. All pharmaceuticals are arranged by the contractor. And in addition, if the inmate needs to have off-site care, if they need to have surgery, if they need to see a specialist, the contractor will approve and make those arrangements. A few words of background about inmate characteristics as they pertain to health care. National research has generally shown that prisoners tend to be less healthy than counterparts their own age in the general population. The percentage of Minnesota inmates older than age 50 has been growing, from less than 6% in 1998 to up close to 14% in 2013. So we have an aging offender population. About a third of inmates have been diagnosed with a chronic condition such as asthma, diabetes, or hypertension. More than 60% of inmates are on medications of some sort. About 30% of inmates are on a psychotropic medication for mental health purposes. Data collected over a recent decade indicate that Minnesota prisons have a low mortality rate compared with other state prison systems. There may be various reasons that account for that, and the impact of the prison health care system on those rates is unclear. As we undertook this evaluation, we looked for benchmarks or standards that we could use to evaluate these services. And in this case, state statutes were of little help. Minnesota law does require the Commissioner of Corrections to provide professional health care. Beyond that, there's very little that is specific. Court rulings throughout the country have established benchmarks for correctional health care. Nearly 40 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that inmates have a right to adequate health care, and that's under the Constitution's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. And the benchmarks established by the courts have been expanded upon by professional organizations as they have written standards. Most notably, the American Correctional Association, which accredits entire prisons across the country, as well as the National Commission on Correctional Health Care, which just accredits the health care portions of prison operations. I should mention that DOC professes to follow the ACA standards, but they have not actually sought ACA accreditation for a number of years. As I said, there is a lot of health care provided in Minnesota's prisons. Much of it is of a fairly routine nature. In a typical year, there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 200,000 health care, as they're called, encounters between inmates and health care staff. These are typically face-to-face meetings, assessments, screenings, immunizations, things of that sort. About a third of the encounters are with nurses, and about a third are with mental health therapists. While inmates have access to a lot of care, what I'd like to do in the next few slides is just highlight some important areas that we think need attention. And one of these is we looked at timeliness in the way that DOC provides a variety of services, and I want to just highlight a couple of issues. First, the extent to which inmates receive timely initial physical examinations when they enter prison. National organizations have set different standards. At the bottom here, we see that the American Correctional Association standard is that inmates will receive an initial physical exam within 30 days, and that's the policy that DOC has adopted. The other standard-setting organization has set a stricter standard of 7 days. In practice, what we see at DOC is that most of their initial physical exams for men are done compliant with that 30-day standard. Regarding the 7-day standard, about 60% of the initial exams meet that standard, as shown in yellow on the left. In the case of women inmates, under either standard, very few of the DOC initial examinations meet either standard. And we see a similar pattern for initial dental examinations. The two accrediting organizations have the same standard in this case, that these initial exams should be done in 30 days. DOC actually has in policy a much longer standard of 120 days. And in practice, what we see is that for men, most of the initial dental exams are done in 30 days. For women, they're not and are not generally done within the 120 day standard of DOC.
Mr. Alter?
Yes.
Is there a way to assess whether this delay in getting exams has had an impact on inmate health, and does that is there a way then to evaluate if that drives up health care costs for the department?
Mr. Chair, I don't think there's an easy answer to that, and we certainly didn't. In talking with folks at DOC, I think there is a feeling that under these kinds of data, there are some staffing issues that they can address. But as far as the actual impact and whether not being seen initially has an impact on longer-term health, I think that's hard to say.
Very good. Thank you.
Another issue that we raise in the report that relates to access is regarding after-hours emergency care, that is, care during overnight hours. Most of Minnesota's prisons do not have overnight nursing or other medical staff on site, and so when something happens in the overnight hours, it's often left to security staff to take the lead. Professional standards suggest a need for clear policies about dealing with medical emergencies when healthcare staff are not on site. And as we looked at the DOC central office policy, as we looked at what were reported to us by facilities for their practices and policies, it seemed to us that there was a need for clearer central guidance. Prison staff can contact an on-call physician employed by DOC's contractor when something happens overnight, but I should mention that the on-call physicians do not have direct access to the offender's medical records, and that can make it difficult for the physicians to offer advice. Another area that we highlight in the report is services for offenders with chronic conditions. DOC's central office actively manages offenders with certain types of chronic conditions and does provide central guidance for their care. And in particular, offenders with HIV, hepatitis C, tuberculosis, DOC has provided good guidance for those offenders. But for what we usually think of as the more common types of chronic illnesses, such as asthma and diabetes, DOC has not developed central guidelines or protocols, and so at least to some extent each facility has been on its own. And we saw inconsistencies in the frequency of care the facilities provide. And beyond that, we saw that there were even differences in the extent to which the facilities could identify the offenders in the prisons who had chronic illnesses. Moving on next to mental health services for inmates, I want to begin with a couple of positive things that we observed. Generally, DOC has had an expectation that inmates who are on a mental health therapist caseload will be seen every 90 days, and generally this level of contact does in fact occur. Also, we found that DOC has a policy, which we think is a good one, that when an offender moves from one DOC prison to another, that and if that person is on the mental health caseload, that there will be notification of the new facility. DOC has that policy for mental health. I should mention it does not have a similar policy for inmates with chronic illnesses, and we think that that would be a good idea. There's also an expectation that for inmates who see psychiatrists and that are on psychotropic medications, that they would see the psychiatrist every 90 days. DOC does not centrally track visits to psychiatrists, and as I will mention later, we think they should. We obtained records from individual facilities, and it was clear that at least in some of the facilities, they were having difficulty getting timely visits with psychiatrists for all of their inmates. Also, among DOC mental health services, there is a 47-bed mental health unit, a residential treatment unit, at the Oak Park Heights facility. In fact, it has been hard for DOC to provide therapeutic treatment at that residential facility as the number of offenders with difficult behaviors has increased. Also, DOC often has to petition the courts if offenders are not taking their medications voluntarily. It will seek a Jarvis order from the court. What we found and heard from DOC is that it often takes months for those hearings to occur, which is beyond the statutory deadline. So for various reasons, the mental health unit functions more as a crisis center and has been less able than it would like to provide therapeutic care. We also raise issues about segregation units within the prisons. These are units that house offenders who have violated prison rules or maybe require close supervision for some other reason. We found that offenders who have mental illnesses tend to spend a larger share of their prison time in segregation than do other offenders in prison. And I think this raises some questions about whether inmates are disciplined who may instead need some sort of mental health treatment. Research has raised questions about using segregation for inmates with mental illness, suggesting that mental illnesses may worsen due to the impacts of isolation. And while DOC mental health staff do make visits to mentally ill inmates who are in segregated units, there's general agreement that those inmates have less real access to therapeutic care while in segregation than do inmates in other parts of the prison. For example, in many of the segregation units, there is really little opportunity for private discussions with the therapists who come around to do visits.
Mr. Alter, do you know how long an inmate stays in a cell when he's in segregation?
Mr. Chair, the stays vary, obviously, and they can vary from, I think, you know, a couple of days, but longest periods we've seen might be 5 years, is what I'm told. I mean, it can be months at a time. that people are in segregation.
Mm-hmm. I'd be curious to know what the department's going to do to fix this when we can have the commissioner come up. Do you have a percentage of how many mentally ill people are in the seg units?
Mr. Chair, maybe we can get back to you on that one.
Okay.
I'm not sure if we have the data, but we can check.
And one more question, Mr. Alter. Do we know if someone's sentence can be completed while they're still in the seg unit? I would imagine if someone is a discipline problem, and if they can stay as long as 5 years, that their sentence might conclude and they would be released immediately from prison from the seg unit rather than from the general population.
Mr. Chairman, that is my understanding, but maybe KJ Starr can add to that.
Excuse me. Mr. Chairman, there is an initiative DOC has my name is KJ Starr. They have been trying to release people to the mental health unit from the segregation units to allow them time to transition back to some social contact before they're released, because I think the department does realize there's a much higher recidivism rate for those released directly from the segregation unit to the outside world.
I'm sorry, Ms. Starr, so you said that inmates can be released from the segregates?
Sometimes their disciplinary sentences might run up to their release date, but the department may release them to the mental health unit, which is a unit within the maximum security prison, in order to start transitioning them from segregation and help giving them services. So they might not meet the mental health unit criteria for severe and persistent mental illness, but they may transition these people using the mental health unit prior to release because of the recognition of the higher recidivism rates and the hardship on the offender being released directly from segregation to outside.
Ms. Starbitt, that's not a, is that a DOC policy, or is that say it may or it may not?
I don't think it's in policy, but it's an initiative they've been working on. Okay. Not all offenders whose sentence runs all the way up to release date, whose segregation sentence runs all the way up to release date, would be released right to the streets.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Alter, please continue, unless there's questions at this point.
Mr. Chair, throughout our report, we discuss the compliance of DOC Health Services policies and, where possible, their practices with professional standards. And again, we look at the standards of two different bodies. And although DOC doesn't seek accreditation from either one, we think those standards are good benchmarks for looking at DOC services. And just as an example, I mean, we found a mixed picture that sometimes DOC complies with those standards, sometimes it does not. As an example, DOC has a comprehensive suicide prevention policy. It provides annual training in it. That's consistent with standards. On the flip side, an area where DOC does not comply is it does not establish measurable health services goals and objectives. If you're interested in the report, there is an exhibit on page 60 where we kind of walk through some of the what we think are more important areas in which DOC does not comply with professional standards. But again, we think it's a mixed picture. When bad things happen in healthcare facilities, a patient's well-being can be placed at risk. The facility can be the target of lawsuits. And it's generally accepted for community-based facilities that those facilities will be subject to licensure, to accreditation, to some sort of external review. But with DOC facilities, that type of oversight has not been in place. For licensure, state law says that DOC must license all correctional facilities in the state. And the law does not specifically exempt DOC facilities, but DOC believes it would be a conflict of interest to license its own facilities, and so it does not. I think it's worth noting that we have another example in state government with the Department of Human Services, which operates quite a few hospitals, and it does license them and has established kind of a separation of the licensure and the operations duties. So it can be done, but that has been the reason why DOC has not licensed its own facilities. Beyond that, I should mention that DOC has some specialized units that look in many ways like what you would see in a community-based hospital or a nursing home or a mental health program. But those facilities are not licensed or regulated by the Departments of Human Services or Health. When we talked to Health and Human Services about that, they pointed to the fact that DOC is required by law to license its own facilities as the reason that they don't go in and regulate them. So the bottom line is that there is no licensure of either the facilities as a whole or the individual programs. Many healthcare facilities in the community are also accredited by organizations using professional standards. As I mentioned, in the case of DOC about 10 years ago, the department decided that it would no longer seek accreditation. But I will mention that in the response to our report, DOC has announced that it does intend to seek ACA accreditation sometime in the near future. And then finally, some healthcare facilities in the community are subject to independent investigations, for example, by an ombudsman's office. About 10 years ago, the legislature eliminated the state ombudsman for corrections. And so really what we're left with then is if there is, let's say, a death that needs to be investigated, that's done by DOC internally as opposed to by an external investigator. There can still be complaints that are filed with, let's say, the State Board of Medical Practice or nursing, but those tend to be a fairly narrow set of complaints that have to do with the practices of specific individuals, and there are certain complaints that are not within the jurisdiction of those boards. In addition, professional standards emphasize the importance of having strong mechanisms for quality improvement within an organization. And in our view, DOC's quality improvement mechanisms have been limited. I want to focus on the first of the bullets on this slide here. DOC does do clinical mortality reviews when an inmate dies, and those are useful. But we do have several concerns about these reviews. They don't result in public reports. They generally are not shared with the staff who provided care to the inmate who died. The reviews are not completed as quickly as professional standards would suggest, and DOC does not systematically track the implementation of the recommendations coming out of those reports. So we think these are good reports, but they could be more useful. And as I said, I just wanted to briefly touch on DOC does have an internal committee that works on quality improvement, but it was inactive for a couple of years until late last year. It's now been started up again. And also DOC's quality improvement efforts have focused more on process and outcomes, another area where we think they could improve.
Mr. Alter, we have a question for you, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, the one thing that's kind of interesting, and maybe you could answer me, is why doesn't the DOC have somebody come in and do an independent death investigation? Recently there was a murder at a St. Peter facility, and the BCA came in to investigate that, but when I talked to the BCA, they said that their only mission was the actual murder, not policies or not the layout or how something could be changed. So I found out that it's DHS is actually doing the investigation, and when I talked to the employees down there, they weren't comfortable with talking to their boss about what they thought might have been the cause for the murder. And so I was just wondering, what do you think the feasibility is when you have a death in a state facility? I know when we have a death in the county jail, the BCA comes in and investigates that. But somebody from outside the organization seemed like you would get more trust in the investigation being full.
Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, what DOC does do is there is a unit within the department called the Office of Special Investigations, and it operates removed from the actual operations of the facilities. They will come in and do kind of an administrative investigation of the death. They'll treat it like a crime scene. They'll come in, they'll interview people. So that's one type of review that's done, but it is within DOC. Then there will be this clinical review that will be done at a later date that involves a number of people who have clinical expertise that will look at the circumstances, and that's another thing. But I think that what you're correct, I mean, there is not, as we said, there's not, for example, an ombudsman's office who, you know, if there's a death in a DHS facility, would certainly have authority and would typically go in and do a review of the death and could issue a public report. And there is nothing like that on the DOC side.
Senator Cornish.
No, I guess the comment would be that nothing's really ever removed if you've got the same commissioner. No offense to Commissioner Roy, who I trust, but I mean, in any, as long as you can say it's removed, but if it's under the same boss, it's not really removed from the organization. So I think it would be helpful to have a outside investigation in DHS, DOC, wherever a state agency has a murder like this or a death would be. But that's just me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Alter, is there are you recommending that the Department of Corrections reestablish the ombudsman?
Mr. Chair, we put that out as an option, and I want to come to that in just a moment. But I think there are we think that the bottom line is there needs to be more oversight, and that could come through any combination of licensure, accreditation, or the creation of an ombudsman's office. Any or all of those things, I think, would add a level of oversight that would be helpful. And I think there are some costs to be considered. Obviously, creating an ombudsman's office is not free. That's something for you as policymakers to weigh, but I think that's an option that should be on the table.
And Mr. Alter, I should know the answer to this question, but does the DOC have any oversight over our county jails?
Mr. Chair, DOC does license the county jails, and there are rules that are promulgated by DOC that govern operations in the county jails, and DOC does have an inspection unit within the department that does periodic reviews of the jails and looks at their compliance.
And do they also have mortality reviews at county jails?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware that DOC does any mortality review, but maybe they could speak to that later.
Very good. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, I want to wrap up with a couple of slides before getting to some legislative recommendations, a couple of slides to talk about just some management issues, just because I think that those are of interest to this committee. We observed that DOC's health services spending has increased in recent years, but what we found is that increase largely reflects general inflation for health care services that have occurred nationwide, combined with growth in the state's prison population. Another issue that we talk about is offender copayments. State law mandates a $5 copay per inmate visit, and DOC has adopted a policy that authorizes various exemptions to the copay requirement. And our concern is that even though we think that most of the exemptions that DOC has adopted in policy are reasonable, for example, exemptions for mental health visits or exemptions for provider-initiated visits, those exemptions are not explicitly authorized in law, and I'll come back to that in our recommendations in just a moment. And then we heard some concerns about pharmaceuticals, some people who said to us, even within DOC, you know, too many pharmaceuticals are being prescribed. We did look at patterns, and in fact, in recent years, there's actually been a reduction in both expenditures and orders for pharmaceuticals. I can't offer any clinical observations on the impact of that, but at least on the spending and the volume, it has declined somewhat. But what we also offer a comment on is we looked at pricing for pharmaceuticals. There is a unit within the Department of Administration that purchases pharmaceuticals for state corrections agencies throughout the country in about half of the states. We had them do a comparison between the prices that DOC has been paying through its contractor in a recent year and the prices that were paid on those same dates by the Department of Administration. And the Department of Administration's prices were somewhat better. So we think that's a resource that is in the state that is a good one that the department should periodically use it at a minimum for comparison purposes, even if it doesn't contract with the Department of Administration to purchase pharmaceuticals. And then a couple other management issues. Staffing plans that outline staffing needs, rationales, and backup plans are recommended by professional standards. They're even required by DOC policy. DOC has not developed annual staffing plans for health services, but we think they should. We haven't talked much today about the DOC health services contractor. The fact that DOC has a contract arrangement of this sort is not unusual among states, but I do think that the blend of having a lot of DOC employees and a contractor and very much splitting those responsibilities is a bit unusual. And in interest of time, I won't go into examples unless you have questions, but I do think that that has been a challenge for DOC to kind of work out those divisions of responsibility and ensure that everybody's on the same page.
Mr. Alter, is that a cost-saving measure by the department, or what's the rationale for having so many services contracted out?
Mr. Chair, I think there's a variety of rationales. I think cost would probably be one, but I also think that, keep in mind that these are very specialized services, and I think the DOC feels as if the infrastructure it would take to recruit and retain and oversee very specialized professionals, and we're talking about physicians and psychiatrists in particular, that's something that they would prefer to leave to a management company that does this in other states and elsewhere. And so I think, you know, and I think that they have generally felt comfortable. They've done this for quite a number of years and have felt as if the services they've gotten have generally been acceptable. So that's why they've done it.
Okay.
We did observe that the most recent contract that DOC entered into, which took effect in January, included a significant profit level for the new vendor that they selected, a higher profit level than the other bids that DOC received. We observed that DOC hasn't tracked administrative costs and profits, actual profits, in the past, and we suggest that they do that in the future, if nothing else, to help with future RFPs. And lastly, just another management issue is we think there are some weaknesses in medical records. When people come from the jails to DOC, DOC rarely gets good medical records on those individuals from the jails. And DOC does not internally have electronic medical records, and as you can imagine, as people move from one facility to the next, or as they receive many different types of care within the prison, that can complicate record keeping and care. So rather than going through all of the recommendations, and most of our recommendations in this report are directed to DOC, and I can certainly talk about any of those DOC recommendations, but I'd like to just wrap up and focus on the recommendations that we have to the legislature on this last slide. We do think that DOC should, or the legislature should, improve oversight of DOC's health services, again, by requiring licensure, accreditation, creating an ombudsman, or some combination of these. At a minimum, we do think that the legislature should clarify in law that the Departments of Health and Human Services should regulate in some way those specialized health care units within the prisons. We also think the legislature should clarify DOC's authority to adopt exemptions to the statutory copay requirements. And again, we think most of the exemptions that DOC has adopted are reasonable, but we think they need to be authorized. And our final recommendation is one that I think merits careful consideration. I talked before about the mortality reviews, and there is statutory language that requires or establishes review organizations, such as the one that does these mortality reviews in DOC, and that statutory language classifies those reports as being not public. We think that when we're, and that language applies to both a variety of private and public organizations. We think that when we're talking about investigations of actions within public organizations, there's certainly an argument for those reports being public. DOC's raised the issue, and I think it's one worth considering, that if those were to be public reports, there might be some reluctance among employees to cooperate fully with those investigations. But, you know, at the same time, I think it's important to have full accountability when bad things happen in these facilities. So we think that's an issue to be considered. So again, our other recommendations in the report, and there are many, are for the Department of Corrections. I can certainly touch on those or answer questions on any other questions you have.
Questions for Mr. Alter before we bring the DOC up. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question about the health services contractor. You identified the fact that there could be some improvement there. Mike, I have a couple of questions. One, I assume that's a pretty good-sized contract. I'd like to know just how big that is, or approximately. And was the bidding process fair, and how could we save money?
Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Uglum, it is a big contract in a given year. It's about, in fiscal year 13, it was about a $28 million contract. and we didn't look top to bottom at the bidding process. It seemed to us it was a reasonable process. They got bids from three companies to provide the full range of services that are in the contract currently. DOC, I should mention again, had been using the same contractor since, I believe, 1998, 99, somewhere in there, a company called Corizon. They made a change last year and went to a company called Centurion. And I think the feeling was, even though the bids of those two companies, the overall bids, came in about the same, I think DOC felt that overall they liked the services that Centurion offered and some of their track record, and so they went with them. So the overall bids, I mean, if we were to assume that DOC was going to either go with who they went with or with their previous contractor, were about the same. So they weren't going to save money under either scenario. It would have been about the same. In terms of contract savings, you know, I think it probably goes back to policies about what services are going to be provided to prisoners. There may be cost savings that contractors can get through better oversight, but it's also a question of, are there certain things that inmates have access to that they shouldn't? They get the full range of services, and you know, we didn't address that in the report.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, I do have another question about the copays. With these exemptions, do we have any idea what the cost of these exemptions have been?
Mr. Alter?
Mr. Chair, that's, and Representative Uglum, that's a good question, and I've never seen an estimate of that, because I don't think we know for sure exactly how many exemptions there have been. The exemptions for mental health, there are many mental health visits, as we pointed out, and so that one would have a significant cost impact. There are some other exemptions that would be much more minor. And as I said, we think that most of the exemptions are reasonable. You know, an example of one that we think DOC should take another look at is DOC exempts sports-related injuries from having to have a copay. If somebody, you know, wrenches a knee when they're out in the yard playing basketball, technically they would be exempted from copay. That doesn't really follow community practice. We think it's something DOC should take a look at. I don't know if that's a lot of cases, but, it's kind of an example. I think that, as I said, the mental health exemption would certainly be a large one that would account for a lot more visits.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think we should take a real hard look at that, because I know that if I foul myself up playing hockey or basketball, I'm going to have a copay. This money goes back into the health system for the DOC. So I would like to see us, it's in law. I think we need to do a better job that way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, and sir, when you look at the health care, theoretically, what is the professional standard? I know they probably got some technical terms, but what's our duty to these prisoners or inmates?
Mr.
We're calling them patients here. But far as, do we have to maintain their health? Is it what it was when they came in, or do we have to improve their health? Or if they come in with cancer, do we have to cure them? Theoretically, what's the state's position in DOCs of what we have to do for the people when they come in? We have to raise their level of care, or we can't put them on Minsure because that would be cruel and unusual punishment. But so,
that's not true. Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, and I'll let KJ Starr assist me with this answer, but I think in terms of what DOC is obligated to provide is really driven largely by what the court rulings have been about what states' obligations are to provide adequate care and what that means. And the bar under the Constitution is a fairly high one. I mean, basically what the courts have said is that prison officials must have acted with deliberate indifference, is the term that has been used, in order to have violated constitutional rights. Now, having said that, there can also be issues that are not constitutional ones about whether or not malpractice has occurred, and there can be civil lawsuits that are not filed under a constitutional claim, And those have a lower bar, but under the Constitution, it is a fairly high bar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions before we bring the department up? You'll stay, Mr. Alter, then? You'll stay? Yes. Commissioner Roy, do you want to please come up? And I don't know, I guess we don't have, we have about 25 minutes or so, so I don't know how much of the report you want to address, and I guess I'm wondering how realistic it is to come up with a bill to put some of these recommendations into statute, but we'll have to deal with that later. But I'll just let you respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, to my left is Nanette Larson, our Director of Health Services, and to my right is Deputy Terry Carlson, who is in charge of our prison system and our health care within the prison system. I will make a few opening comments, and both individuals left and right are ready to respond to questions. And I should immediately point you to the end of the blue document, which is our response to the legislative auditor, point by point by point. And it actually could be called an action plan. It's the very last section in that blue report. So I think when you ponder the recommendations in the front, you could immediately reference those in the back of the report. And with that opening comment, I'll make a couple more. And we really respect the work of the legislative auditor. They have produced really comprehensive documents in the past. They are often referenced, and they are very diligent, and they were very diligent in this report. And the level of scrutiny that they gave to our process is significant. We have agreement in many areas, and in some areas we have disagreement, and those are reflected in the responses that we provided in the back. Two very notable items came forward from this report for me as commissioner. And immediately, members left and right should note that we spend a lot of money on health care in the Minnesota prison system. We are fifth highest in 39 states that were referenced. And I wouldn't be surprised if all the states were referenced, we would be in the top 10 of spending on medical care. That is a pretty significant indication of our commitment to provide reasonable medical care, community standard. And the other notable item that I think is probably the most important response or the finding within the legislative auditor's report, Mr. Alter did reference already, and he described it as a low mortality rate. Actually, the reference in the report is that we have the lowest mortality rate of the 49 states reporting within that document. And I would not be surprised if that 50th state were identified that we would be the best. And if any of you are pondering a future in a medical facility, I would hope that all of you would consider what mortality rate exists within that facility, whether that be for yourself or an elderly family member. I wouldn't suggest, of course, that there be a utilization of a corrections facility for a loved one, but I think it could do a lot worse. This is a pretty significant finding, and it's very indicative, we believe, of the quality of care that's being provided in our facilities. The reference document for that is included in your packet, and it looks like this. It is entitled Number of State Prisoner Deaths by Cause of Death 2001 to 2010. And that gives you an indication, and probably the saddest statistic on that sheet is the top left corner that says in that decade over 32,000 or about 32,000 inmates died in prisons in the United States. In that same report, it indicates that in Minnesota over that decade, 127 people died And you can see left to right the causes of those deaths. And if you immediately then reference this colorful report, I have listed states that are close to us in their demographics, in their state population. The column next to it is the prison population. And then those exact same states, we listed the number from the previously referenced report. And just as a reference point, we gleaned out the heart-related deaths. And I think that's also very indicative, especially when it comes to chronic care that Mr. Alter explained. Again, we feel very proud of the work that we've done with chronic illnesses. And if you look at all those other illnesses across the line, we also believe that we're providing really very, very adequate care. But also reference that care costs a lot of money in the Minnesota system. I think also this report validates the work that we've done in the past 3 years with this administration. We have done significant work in establishing a new RFP for a new healthcare provider. And this past January, we did the transition to the new provider, but there was about a year's worth of work previous to that that established the transition team and what was important to us. We've also rolled out a new prison data tracking system, and that is the platform for a future electronic health records, and many of the items that you will see in this report regard information transfer between facilities, tracking of physician visits, and we believe the EHR, the electronic health records system that we have had in the planning phase and recently, just last year, completed a reassessment of that business plan. This new rollout of our data system provides a platform for that. That consultant provided the cost of that new system, and the Barry Dunn report is available to committee members as well. We've also prepared ourselves for a accreditation audit process, and some of you folks might know about the Prison Rape Elimination Act. That is a federal mandate that we have to reduce sexual assault and harassment within our prisons, and we have to have every facility audited, and the ACA now has indicated that they will also provide a pre-audit. So we're going to put a facility audit, the healthcare system audit, and the pre-audit. We're going to package those, and we have been in negotiation with ACA to do that as well. A lot of reference to mental health and segregation in this report. We are very proud of the work, again, that we have done with training segregation staff in our crisis intervention training model, and we've received lots of recognition. We hope to have 25% of our corrections officer staff trained in this model, and it is the tenet of the model is that it assists corrections officers in dealing with inmates who are in mental health crisis. You don't necessarily need to shackle them or pepper spray them, that the response can be far more humanistic, and we can avoid segregation placements with the use of CIT. We also have, in closing here, Mr. Chair, a very active effort in our transition from prison to the community. We fully recognized how important that transition is, especially for people with medical issues. We have hired additional medical release planners, and those planners develop medical release plans. They facilitate the first visits to community healthcare providers. They make sure prescriptions are accomplished. Some of our folks have mobility issues, senility issues. Some need care in the community, residential care. and our medical release planners accomplish that. We are also exploring, as part of that, the use of telemedicine. And telemedicine is especially important in cost containment, and I know that is a concern for many members of this committee. And it is a technology that we are exploring very aggressively. We have, especially in this transition work, Mr. Alter suggested that about 30% of our inmates have persistent and significant mental health issues. And just today I received a report that over the past, from 2005 to 2010, half of the institutional beds for mental illness were closed in the state of Minnesota. Sheriff Stanek in Hennepin County, the Sheriff's Association, has talked about the default that county jails have become for mental health issues. We are also experiencing the default issue. People that come into our facilities have major problems, and it's often co-occurring problems. 90% of our folks have chemical dependency issues or addictions, and when you throw on top a mental illness, it is a handful to deal with these folks. And the legislature was very kind to us in the past two sessions and did provide us with additional monies for treatment, chemical dependency, and sex offender treatment. And we're very appreciative of that. We are still lacking, and we aren't even coming close to meeting the needs for treatment within our facilities. We have a very active action planning team right now related to this report, and we have developed goals and timeframes to meet that action plan. And the action plan aligns almost directly with those responses that we have had in the back of the report that's in front of you. In terms of the segregation unit, it should be noted that this past week, Senator Durbin in Washington, D.C., called a special session of his, it's a lengthy committee hearing, but it's looking at mental health and crisis mental health issues. And our professional association, the Commissioner's Professional Association, did produce a document talking about what the correction system in this country is doing to address the segregation unit and the persistence of mental illness in those segregation units. When you couple mental illness with dangerousness, with serious physical assault, with self-mutilation, it is a terrible situation in this country. And when you look at the millions of people that are experiencing prison incarceration, it is exacerbated by that population. And we are not alone in this state being challenged with what to do with these folks. It is a national issue, and it's received national attention, as it deservedly should. With that comment, Mr. Chair, I know the committee has many questions, and I am very confident that Ms. Larson and Ms. Carlson can provide those answers for you.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, just a general question. Electronic medical records are a huge, huge deal in the private sector, and touted as a big cost saver, and I can believe that. What's the department doing in order to achieve better electronic medical records at this point?
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I referenced the planning that we have done, but Ms. Larson can very specifically tell you about the time frame and the details.
Ms. Larson, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Nanette Larson. I'm the Health Services Director for the Department of Corrections. A number of years ago, we contracted with a company out of the East Coast called Barry Dunn. They helped us develop our business case for an electronic medical record. And frankly, there's lots of good reasons why we need an electronic health record. In many of our institutions, the mental health staff are separate from the medical staff. And so anytime a psychiatrist needs to see one of our offenders, you got to bring the medical record over to the mental health area. So not efficient. And especially if you're in Faribault and you've got a little cart and it's the middle of winter. Not a good thing. So business case is there. They also helped us develop an RFP with 934 business requirements that we could let tomorrow if we had the funding to do that. We recently issued an RFI, a request for information, to see if there were any folks out there who might be interested in bidding on our business and to get a better handle on the cost. We had four bidders, and so this will tell you how good the cost is. One bid was $9 million, and the other bid was $900,000. So somewhere in the middle, that is where it's going to cost us.
Another bid.
Yeah, I'm sorry, the request for information, right. And then we've also asked Barry Dunn to look at some of the existing systems that are in use by other state agencies. So what is DHS using for their population? What are the vets' homes using for their population? And so they've provided an analysis for us with that about that as well. So might it be better to use that, but we would still need money to obviously buy that. So that's where we are.
Okay. I guess that answers my question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Commissioner, I noticed that I haven't had a chance to review all of your responses, but it's a little difficult to maybe we'll need to have you come back at some point, because sometimes you say you agree with the recommendation made by the OLA, and then you say the department already does this, so it seems like there's a difference of opinion on whether you are accomplishing what they are recommending. Did you have disagreements with the OLA report?
Mr. Chair, there are areas of disagreement, and they are noted in our responses. Sometimes it is just an issue of it's minor detail, and sometimes it's a major disagreement.
And I noticed under 17 on the improving oversight over health services, you don't really respond to the recommendation to create a state ombudsman for corrections.
Mr. Chair, we do have a response, and we think that the accreditation process should provide a quality assurance. The ombudsman is a very expensive alternative, and we have not fully explored that recommendation in terms of the exact cost or the models that may be available. For instance, DHS Mental Health has an ombudsman, and I personally don't know what the effect of or the cost of those are within those departments. Deputy Carlson, do you have any input?
Mr. Deputy Chair, Carlson. My name is Terry Carlson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Facilities Division. I just want to note, as a technicality, in our responses, when it was the legislature should consider something, we didn't respond with an agree or not, because we only responded to what the department should do.
So, okay. So in terms of a legislative response, it's probably wouldn't have time to do anything this legislative session. If we were to draft a bill so I'm not sure how we would deal with that. Other questions of the commissioner? Can I just say, I have always been a major, major supporter of the department, and I think, you know, touring our facilities, and I know how committed the staff is and the leadership has been. And I know that it's the responsibility of this committee to look carefully at the costs related to services and healthcare services. And, you know, I just want to address one part of the report, and I think it needs, I hope that the committee will explore it in more detail at some point. And that's how we are or aren't dealing with inmates who have mental health problems. I guess I don't have to tell you this, but 95% of these inmates, these offenders, are going to be leaving those prisons, and they're going to be moving back into our neighborhoods. And whether it's sex offenders, whether it's people with severe mental illness, they're getting out. And so I think whenever we limit treatment or we don't look at the innovative ways that we might be able to deal with some of their mental health problems, I think we do that at our peril, because these are going to be the people that are going to recidivate. And I know most of you have taken tours of these facilities, and I'm glad that the report addresses what the American Psychiatric Association has said about segregation units, and I'm glad Congress is taking a look at it, because it's not only inhumane, but we're exacerbating these people's mental illness. If you think of staying in one of those cells with chronic mental illness, severe mental illness, 23 out of 24 hours a day, whether it's at Oak Park Heights or Stillwater or any of the other facilities, and then you're getting out, then society has a big problem on its hand. And Commissioner Roy, I know that we've had a discussion about this, and I know you agree with me, and I know that the solutions are complex. But I'd like to believe that this committee and future finance committees would look favorable to you coming up with a different kind of solution. And I don't know what other states are doing to address this, but I know we have a serious, serious, serious problem. And so any other comments before we... Representative Cornish.
Commissioner, what do you folks have on, when you're talking about the mentally ill there, are you encumbered with same regulations like in the rules of engagement, like the security hospital? I know the security hospital is even less than the sex offender program. They've been taking almost all their tools for restraints away, and they got unbelievably high rate of assault on the security there at the mentally ill and dangerous unit. And I wonder if, and they talk about Rule 36, they talk, and I don't know if you have the same rule, but do you have a rule of engagement? If somebody is designated mentally ill, are you restricted in how you handle them as far as clubs or tasers or restraints or handcuffs? Or
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, we differ significantly in that our folks are offender inmates, and DHS, of course, are patients. We have a continuum of force that is consistent. As a law enforcement officer, I know you are familiar with that continuum of force. And it is utilized for all inmates. But if you the testimony I gave regarding our crisis intervention training, we tried to throw an element into that response that doesn't involve force or violence against that person. If we can talk a person down from that immediate issue, it saves injury to our employees, which is very important, and it may save a segregation stay or and a referral to a mental health. And if you need... And we have been offering that training to other law enforcement agencies around the state as well. And it is actually, if the Mr. Chair would give me a moment to talk about a very positive situation. A recently trained corrections officer was on a medical response transport to the Hennepin County facility. And while he was guarding our inmate, a staff came down the hallway and indicated that a mental health patient had a Hennepin County staff hostage with a pair of scissors to the neck. And because of this training, our corrections officer was able to intervene in that really scary situation. And there's many people that believe that he may have saved that person's life, and in fact did get a national award for that intervention based on his training. So it's not always corrections officers, tough guys. It's often the best weapon and the best response is the verbal response. And most people know that.
Sure. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Roy, you made a comment during this presentation about half the mental health beds being closed. Can you explain what happened and why they were closed?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I referenced an article, and my expertise and my life for 40 years has been in the corrections world, and I have not been that close to facility institutional closing. I think, though, generally the mental health community, and I think generally most citizens think that institutionalizing people for long periods of time may not necessarily make them healthier, and this notion of community treatment I think works for many, but I think that sometimes the community resources are not equitable around the state. Sometimes in urban areas there are not programs for significantly and persistently mentally ill folks, so those people probably would prosper with community treatment, but oftentimes they don't make themselves available for that treatment and end up in our correctional facilities.
Are there any other questions? Ms. Larson, Deputy Commissioner Carlson, Commissioner Roy, thank you for your testimony. Mr. Alter, thank you for the wonderful report, and we'll look.
I forgot to ask.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have one more. Representative Rosenthal, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I know Michigan has been doing stuff with Medicaid expansion and prisoners. Could you know anything about that, and have you thought about that model at all?
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Rosenthal, we actually have been working with the Department of Human Services to enroll our offenders into Medicaid when they become inpatient hospital admissions. Federal law allows us to do that. We've taken the opportunity to make that happen. So effective January 1 of 2014, they will be enrolled in Medicaid upon inpatient hospital admission. And then that just keeps that going. When they come back to us, though, they're not part of Medicaid. Upon release, we will also be enrolling them into some form of Medicaid. So we've taken advantage of that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cornish.
Just was wondering about the procedure here, if when we're going to see this Thursday schedule. I know it's a short session, but we usually have a little more warning, 3 days or something.
The schedule for the rest of the week is we're going to take up Representative Simonson's synthetic drug bill, and there's I have a bill on the safe harbor trafficking, and Thursday's the bonding provisions that the department is recommending.
Okay.
Is there any other bills? Okay. With that, thank you all, Mr. Alter. Thank you for the report. This meeting's adjourned.